forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
We will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlies Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture, and I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock. They've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Sai Purza, London.
Fuel prices have slightly dropped in Yemen after the release of two Yemeni fuel ships
that were detained by the Saudi-led coalition earlier this week in the Red Sea. The Yemeni army issued a stern warning to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that if the ships were not released soon, military action would follow. Yemeni bus and motorbike drivers in the capital Sana'a, who make a living from public transportation, welcome the lowering of fuel prices. They say this is going to help them cope with the fuel price hike caused by the blockade.
As you can see, I am pumping 1 liter for only 500 Yemeni riyals, whereas before it used to cost us 1,500 to 2,000 for 1 liter.
The Saudi-led coalition who are seizing Yemeni fuel ships do not respond to peaceful dialogue. They only respond to us when we decide to use our military power, and if that's the case, so be it.
Yemeni political expert says the release of the fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition isn't enough, as Yemen will continue to struggle until Saudi Arabia and its allies completely lift the blockade and end their illegal involvement in Yemen.
Although the price of fuel has slightly dropped, we still need to look at the more pressing issue, and that is the fact that the Saudi-led coalition is still occupying Yemen. We need to reach an ultimate solution that can only come through taking decisive military actions against them. This is the only solution.
Despite falling oil prices, tensions are rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen for what could soon be a resumption of war if a political solution is not reached soon. This as Saudi Arabia and the UAE continue their militarization of strategic Yemeni islands in the Red and Arabian Sea.
The release of Yemeni fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition marks a big victory for the Yemeni government based in Sana'a and to the people living in the areas controlled by Ansar Allah. This also indicates that Saudi Arabia and the UAE simply cannot afford to have their oil industry targeted by Yemeni ballistic missiles, which is why they chose a safer option by releasing the fuel vessels. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
...2022 has been dominated by a cost of living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people. We'd get their prescriptions, we'd get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people, some people, forced to choose between heating and eating? I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, you know, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
Caskets with the remains of unidentified martyrs draped in Iranian flags and carried in mass processions. For many Iranian families, the painful legacy of the eight-year Iran-Iraq War, referred to as the Sacred Defense, drags on after more than three decades as they hopefully wait for news of loved ones still missing.
The martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatimeh, Lady Fatimeh, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, became the perfect occasion to bid farewell to 400 unknown soldiers of the eight-year Iraqi imposed war.
In the capital, Tehran, the last farewell on Tuesday honored 200 soldiers whose remains were recently recovered from the former battlefields along the Iran-Iraq border. Funerals were held for another 200 soldiers in other cities and towns across Iran. None of the soldiers have been identified, and their remains are to be buried as unknown martyrs.
We should never forget the martyrs, their families, and the sacrifices they made for us to be here today. And the occasion of Hazrat Fatima's martyrdom anniversary is the best reminder of that.
Iran has been the scene of foreign-backed riots since mid-September, and many who attended the funeral procession saw it as an opportunity to send a message to the enemies of the Islamic Republic.
I personally came here because I think that at this very crucial point in time, it is important for me and my generation to show support for the Islamic Republic of Iran, to show that the way mainstream media is trying to portray Iran these days is fake news, and that my generation will always uphold the values of those who lost their lives for the independence of our country.
We will walk down the same path as our martyrs. Our presence here is a clear message to all of our enemies and the rioters in particular.
We have pledged allegiance to our leader Ayatollah Khamenei, and no matter what happens, we will always support the leader. Especially these days, it is even more important to be vocal about it.
Trucks piled high with the caskets made their way through the streets. Men and women in black followed them weeping for those who lost their lives in a bloody war which left more than a million casualties on both sides. But most importantly, they turned out once again to pledge allegiance to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a controversial Title 42 border policy. But what is a Title 42 policy in the first place, and why is it important? For starters, it uses public health as a justification for expelling asylum seekers. But is that justified under the norms of human rights, especially when it comes to asylum seekers and international law? And why have rights groups characterized it as arbitrary and illegal? In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at the controversy surrounding not only this Title 42 provision, but whether the issue of asylum seekers, which has been a problem for the U.S., has its roots in maybe U.S. foreign policy. Let's find those questions and a lot more from our guests. Let me introduce them. Barbara Petillo joins us. He's a political activist and attorney from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, David K. Johnson, investigative journalist and author, who joins us from Rochester, New York. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Barbara Petillo, I'll start first with you. And, of course, given the name, maybe some are not aware what it is, I included. And you can explain to us what it is and why is it that it's been used by the current and previous U.S. administrations, which appears on the surface anyways, in order to expel either migrants or asylum seekers.
Well, the United States has had an issue with immigration dating back 40 years. The last time we had any major efforts to ameliorate the problem was Ronald Reagan back in 1986, when he granted what many call amnesty to all of the, or to a large number of migrants who are currently in the country at that time. Since then, America has kicked the can down the road on what's called comprehensive immigration reform. This will be reforming our border, instituting border security, creating a pathway to citizenship, dealing with our guest worker program, modernizing our H-1B visa program to bring high-skilled laborers over, in addition to dealing with DACA. Those are children who were brought to this country as infants who grew up here but do not have citizenship standards. Concurrent with this, during the beginning parts of the pandemic, the Trump administration, because they had not been able to pass comprehensive immigration reform in 2018, instituted this policy, Title 42, which allows the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Naturalization Services to deport migrants and asylum seekers without going through the normal process of claiming asylum, having a hearing under international law, under the pandemic emergency. Since then, almost all the pandemic emergency powers have been repealed, be that masking in public, vaccine mandates, separation, those sorts of things. But Title 42 remains in place. The Biden administration has sought to allow Title 42 to expire in order to return to the traditional method within the kind of international law for asylum seekers. However, the Supreme Court has overruled him on that.
I was trying to keep up with all the fact that you were giving me. I think I gave up halfway through it. I do apologize for that. But before I go to David K. Johnson, what I want to find out from you, did what Trump do in terms of this Title 42 something that was legal in the way that he presented it and came up with this in terms of wanting to reach his goal of not letting people in the U.S., whether they're asylum seekers or migrants?
Well, presidents are normally granted special emergency powers during national emergencies. President Trump used the excuse of the coronavirus pandemic to institute Title 42 towards his broader gain, broader goal of reducing immigration from Central and South America. However, that was supposed to expire when the emergency was over. What the courts have done, because we have a 6-3 conservative majority on the court, they have overruled the president, they have overruled the Congress, and basically, according to Justice Gorsuch, made themselves the arbiter of U.S. immigration law, which is outside the constitutional bounds of what the court is supposed to do.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, W.K. Johnson, what do you think? Tell us maybe in a bit simpler terms as to what you think about this, but overall, what's the crisis and controversy about here?
Well, first of all, everything Robert Petillo told you is right on the money, so let me give a little broader context to this. There is, in the history of the world, no wealthy country bordering or near a poor country or countries that has kept people from coming in. Human beings who get up and leave tend also to be the people who have the most gumption and accomplish something. And U.S. foreign policy is right at the heart of this. In Honduras, where many of the people coming to the U.S. southern border come from, a country I have visited 3 times in this century, I'm not surprised people are leaving. 12-year-old girls are being pressed into prostitution by criminal gangs. Young boys are being forced into joining these gangs and committing crimes. Tegucigalpa, the capital, is the most dangerous city in the Western Hemisphere. And so, of course, there are people who are going to either send their children or take their children in an effort to get asylum. And under American law, they have an absolute right to appear at a proper border station and seek asylum. The problem is, as Robert Petillo pointed out, since Ronald Reagan's version of an amnesty, there has been nothing serious done by Congress. And Donald Trump, who began his campaign for president with a racist tirade against Mexicans, calling them murderers and rapists, used Title 42 in an effort to stop any immigration. It had nothing to do with the law. It had to do with his racist policies. So now you have pent-up demand of people who want to come. And that is creating a real and serious problem, one that could be addressed by better U.S. government policies, both at the border and in foreign policy.
So let's play out the scenario here on the humanitarian side, which needs to be addressed, Robert Petillo. And I'm wondering what you think about it when you have these people who are fleeing. We're going to get to some of the reasons why they may be fleeing their homeland. But they're fleeing where they're coming from, making that dangerous journey, which is dangerous within itself, making that journey, then getting to the border area, perhaps. And then over there, they want to obviously get into, in this case, the U.S. But then they're facing a whole raft of other dangers, where when you take a look at some of the records of what has happened to them, shocking instances of sexual and physical abuse is what I'm reading. You have instances of rape, in some cases murder, that have happened. And in the case of sexual and physical abuse, I'm reading the U.S. border and federal officers have been involved in that. Is there no monitoring of this to happen when they get there, that we're seeing these instances?
I think me and David were going to agree that there's little to no monitoring. And part of the issue is that when you create this illicit system, as we have currently, instead of being able to simply follow the international law, present yourself and enter the country under asylum, because most of you people are seeking asylum because of U.S. government policy. Let's not forget that. Because of the war on drugs, because of the banana republic wars that the U.S. launched, because of our propensity for replacing democratically elected leadership with U.S. puppet governments, that's why these people are fleeing those countries. But because we do not have a proper system in place, that creates coyotes who are human smugglers who are able to take these people from their homes. They sell all of their property and belongings to give their children a chance for a better life, and often do not make it there. If the American does not reform this system, they have no moral authority to stand up and look at China or any other nation and say that they need to reform their human rights laws. All they've done is push it across the border so they don't have to look at it and see the results of what their policies have been.
All right. Our guest there, David K. Johnson, talked about some of the reasons perhaps that the U.S. May be at fault here, if you agree with them. And if you can give us some examples of some of the countries that perhaps, due to U.S. foreign policy or otherwise, has impacted the lives, and I'm guessing it's mostly economically driven, that they feel that they have to leave the country unless it's for safety and security concerns.
Well, what's happened in Honduras, which is where many of the people at the border are coming from, has been the long-term support of governments that have been unsuccessful in dealing with crime, have been quite corrupted by the drug traffic. But, you know, the U.S. is a place people want to come to, and we are indeed mishandling this at the border. But imagine if something happens in Pakistan, Afghanistan, or Azerbaijan, and floods of people want to get into Iran. Is there any reason to believe that your country would do better at this than we're doing? I mean, these are problems that we see pop up around the world. The Australians are having problems with this, is an excellent example. And part of their solution has been to take people and put them on the islands off the Northern Territories. So, but much as the U.S. is not handling this well, I think we need to see it in a global context.
This global context is very important because here, as our guest there said, Robert Padillo, Iran has been on the receiving end of many Afghans, especially after the Shadi, to say the least, U.S. Withdrawal of the occupation of that country, where we really had an uptick in the volume of Afghan refugees, asylum seekers, whatever name you would like to put on it, that came and flowed into Iran. And we did our best, and we still continue to do that. So we know exactly how that feels. But when it comes to this issue, to put it in the world context, where in the what parts of the world is there this flow or problem where there's not it's not a result of a foreign policy of another country? I mentioned the U.S. because not to just pinpoint the U.S. because the U.S. is involved in so many different excursions, if you want to call it, around the world, whether it's through itself covertly, indirectly, or with its allies, that has resulted in that. Maybe you can expand a little bit more for us, whatever examples that comes to your mind. Robert Padilla.
Yeah, I think a perfect example will be countries that are affected by narco-terrorism. These drug cartels are primarily being financed by the American drug habit. 50% of the cocaine in the world is consumed in the United States of America, the good old U.S. of A. And this gives substantial power to the drug cartels, to FARC and other groups that are able to overthrow governments, that are able to bring down the ruling classes and replace them with simply narco government officials who have to buy in for protection. You look at a nation like Venezuela, which was a prosperous nation 20 years ago, but after the failed coup attempt by President Trump when he attempted to replace President Maduro with Juan Guaido, we saw massive waves of migrants leaving Venezuela to try to come to the United States. And then when they get there, the very same political instability that was caused by Trump, they are met with Trump's Title 42 border policy. You can go all the way through the 1980s, the U.S. Great Invasion of Grenada, their intervention in Panama. You can go back to the Banana Republic Wars when Chiquita Banana was able to basically overthrow governments in Central America. All of these things are part of the American sphere hegemonic influence, and because of that, there is a responsibility even beyond that, which is articulated in international law, to take in these migrants. Not to mention, these individuals are a net positive to the U.S. economy. Nobody's walking 1,000 miles through the
Good
desert
point.
To come get on social services.
That's a great point, which I want to ask you, David K. Johnson. Whether it's the U.S., of people trying to get into the U.S., or whether it's Europe, much of the people who actually do make it inside the country are involved in the part of the economy that many people of those countries perhaps are not interested in or cannot fill those positions. So they do serve a purpose. Maybe that's something that you could expand on it for us, if you agree with that.
Almost everyone in the United States came here, or their ancestors came here from somewhere else. Mine came in mostly in the late 1800s. And immigrants who arrive with no skills are denounced by the far right in America. But what the research shows is that they are very hard workers. They push their children to be well educated. And by the second, or at the latest, the third generation, almost without exception, they are prosperous. So absolutely, we would be better off if we had a more open policy about immigration. Canada has done very well with its immigration policies. Now, those policies change the nature of who the population is, the demographics of the population. And the people who are white supremacists, the Trumpers, they don't like that. They only want Western and Northern Europeans being allowed to immigrate to the United States. And the world just doesn't work that way.
Okay, great point. Another great point. So, Robert Padilla, let's expand on that. How much of the U.S. population actually feels that way? We know Trump obviously highlighted that, whether he wanted or not, or whether that was just a reflection of his personality, of the type of people that the U.S. should be composed of in terms of, let's say, whoever wants to enter. But is there that kind of a discrimination when it comes to the types of people who want asylum in the U.S. who then obviously want to be employed in the workforce?
Yes, there is. I'll give you an example that when Russia invaded Ukraine, they announced that 100,000 Ukrainian migrants would be coming to America to seek asylum from the war there, and there was absolutely no outrage. You did not hear the political right, saying that they are coming to change your way of life, this, that, and the other, because they are completely fine with European migrants coming here to seek asylum. During the Trump administration, they said, well, why can't we get more people from Norway and the Netherlands to come to the United States of America? And this is not a strict strictly America problem. Giorgia Meloni, the new prime minister in Italy, she does not want African migrants coming to Italy. She says she wants Venezuelan migrants who have lighter skin and who come from a Latin background, who speak a similar language, speaking Spanish versus Italian, and says they can incorporate into the society better there. This has been the policy of the United States of America since the 1800s. Since the Mexican-American War, there was an opportunity for America to annex the entirety of Mexico, but they decided not to do so because they did not want to change the racial composition of America to being a majority Latino nation. And this remains the part of American foreign policy, is the unspoken part, where the reason that this is an issue is that if this was migration coming from Canada to America, it wouldn't be a problem. The fact that it's black and brown people descended from slavery who are coming to this country, that is why this suddenly becomes an issue.
All right, and we know that this, as our guest from Washington, Robert Padilla, indicated, David K. Johnson, has been a problem that it seems like it's been kicked down the road by different U.S. presidents who have come into power. Why has there not been, first of all, a solution that has been effective? Is there one? And or are we seeing this being used as a basis for political maneuvering when it comes to, for example, wanting to have some popularity amongst the general population, an issue that perhaps is used that way?
Well, except for Donald Trump, American presidents actually have tried to get solutions. The problem is in Congress. We have a deeply divided Congress. There's a joke in Washington where back before Ronald Reagan, Democrats and Republicans would jointly rent a house or an apartment and live together. And today the joke is that a Democrat and Republican riding in a taxi together is a major act of bipartisanship. So the core of this is the inability to get enough members of Congress on one side or the other politically to move forward. The solutions to this are multiple. One of them, obviously, is changes in U.S. foreign policy, not doing things like overthrowing governments, as the U.S. did 70 years ago in your country, and installing regimes that American non-elected leaders think would be better for U.S. interests. That's an important one. It's especially true in Central America, where many of the people at the southern border are coming from, not Mexico, but south of Mexico. Secondly, we have to address the drug trafficking. So long as drugs are illegal, we're going to continue to have this problem. Drug prices are falling, which tells you the war on drugs doesn't work. And we need to decide we're going to take our losses in a different way, not by corrupting law enforcement and courts, but by instead, and foreign governments, but by instead accepting that some people are going to be drug abusers and they're going to suffer the consequences. That would reduce the power of these criminal cartels in a number of countries outside the U.S. And then we need to have an adequately staffed and system for allowing asylum seekers to come in to have their claims heard, and if they qualify, to let them into the country, and if they don't, to send them back. But we don't fund this in an adequate way, and again, Congress controls funding. The real core of the problem here is Congress, particularly the far-right racist elements in the U.S. Congress, who want to make America white again. And I'm playing a little on Donald Trump's make it great again.
Okay. All right, taking a look at the U.S. President Joe Biden, Robert Padilla, where does it stand with him in terms of, we know that he wanted to, for example, he wanted to end Title 42 in the spring of 2022, from what we understand, because he felt like, you know, at this point, the pandemic is on the wane, which could now be turning a direction, but putting that aside, is he somebody that you see that can help the situation, enact anything that perhaps can improve the conditions, especially at the border in terms of that aspect of it, but on a larger scale, whether it can do anything to stop the people from making that move in the first place? I think that would require Biden to talk with the leaders of the other country, like maybe Obrador in Mexico, to see what it can be done. And I think he has, but we're not seeing the major improvement that is required, have we?
Well, no, and I think if Biden was going to do something major on immigration, it would have had to be done last year. In January of next year, we're going to get a Republican House of Representatives with a Republican Speaker of the House, and they will have absolutely zero appetite to have comprehensive immigration reform. At the same time, President Biden is now confronted by a 6-3 majority for conservatives on the Supreme Court. After for the last several decades, they've been maneuvering to take that institution over, and they have shown that they have no problem being an activist court, overruling the President of the United States, overruling Congress when it comes to our immigration policy. So if he instituted executive action on immigration, it will more than likely be overruled by the court, the same way that we've seen the student loan reform be held up and many other executive actions. So there's very little that President Biden can actually do with regards to immigration in the short term. What they can do is take the current law and the current criteria that we have and try to staff up on federal judges, try to bring in more immigration attorneys, provide more resources from the federal government to handle the current influx, put a real investment into it. The fact that America can spend $850 billion, which is the new defense authorization in the latest budget, $850 billion on national defense, but cannot allocate proper resources to the border to have a humane and just immigration system is beyond comprehension. I think the Biden administration has to use whatever tools are available to ensure that we are streamlining the system as much as possible.
And final question to you, which is a general one, David K. Johnson. Where do we go from here in terms of what's going to happen? I have a feeling that we're going to continue seeing these migrants and asylum seekers, not just coming, trying to come into the U.S., but from other from Mexico, but from other, obviously, countries who will strive to get into the U.S. mainland.
Well, as Robert Perdillo pointed out, nothing will happen in the next 2 years that will be beneficial. There may be some very damaging things that will happen in terms of ginned-up hearings about phony issues, but nothing towards resolving these issues will occur for the next 2 years. At core, the American people have to make a fundamental decision about where they want to go, what direction they want the country to go, and that'll be reflected in who is elected to Congress. And of course, in America, over the last 30 years or so, Republicans have made a really determined effort to create what are called gerrymandered districts that essentially guarantee Republicans re-election. And we end up with situations like Pennsylvania having 2/3 of its residents Democrats, but 2/3 of its congressional delegation Republicans. So it's not representative. In foreign policy, there we may see some advances. Biden has on several fronts done some remarkable things that are beneficial. And I think we'll see some executive actions, but nothing from Congress.
All right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. Thank you so much. David K. Johnson, investigative journalist and author from Rochester, New York. Robert Petillo, thank you. Political activist and attorney from Washington, D.C. Season's greetings to both of you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavitawe and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
School of Soleimani. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As we approach the anniversary of martyrdom of the great anti-terror general and commander of hearts, Qasem Soleimani, we have prepared a five-part series to commemorate this unmatched general. Stay tuned, please. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the personality of Haj Qasem Soleimani, "Let us not look at the dear martyr, Haj Qasem Soleimani, as an individual. Let us look at him as a course, a path, and a school that teaches lessons." Qasem Soleimani was the great commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, who was martyred on January 3, 2020, through a drone attack near Baghdad Airport by the American Terrorist Army. Qasem Soleimani was born in Qanat Malik village of Rabur city of Kerman province. He writes in his autobiography, "I was born in 1956. I caught measles in a very cold winter. My parents had no hope in my healing. They tested every local medicine, but there was no use in them. According to my father, my mother wrapped me on her back while there was a heavy snow up to the knees and set out for a physician in Rabur. Anyway, after a while, I survived through God's will." Like all villages in Iran, Qanat Malik was very poor during the Pahlavi regime. Therefore, Qasem Soleimani had to leave it for the city at the age of 14. He writes in his autobiography, "My father's debt to the rural bank had made me more concerned than my mother. I cried several times out of the fear of my father's imprisonment. I decided to go to the city to pay my father's debt at any cost. My parents were opposed to me. I was just 14, a weak boy who had only seen Rabur city. His first experience was to work as a worker in a half-constructed building. He continues, "I worked for 6 days from sunrise till near sunset in front of a half-constructed building. My feeble body and young age could not tolerate such a job. My little hands would bleed. His income was low and it would take a long time to pay back his father's debt, so he started working at a hotel. He was working at a fruit juice shop too. Finally, he paid back his father's debt after 5 months." Young Qasem Soleimani was not scared of city anymore. He enrolled at a Zurkhane, a gym where traditional Iranian sport is practiced and taught. He also attended karate classes and got green belt in it. Soleimani writes, "Sport had a great effect on my religious morals and was one of the factors to prevent me from going to immoralities in spite of being young. Bastani sport played a special role in this regard, as it is originated in moral and religious principles." In 1974, he heard a word against the Shah for the first time. While the son of his boss at hotel was speaking of the Shah centers of immorality, one of Qasem's relatives spoke of his oppression and injustice.
Martyr Soleimani writes, I noticed that Bahram was speaking like Ali Yazdan Panah, but not of the Shah's corruption, rather of his oppression as people are detained, imprisoned, and killed. The Shah does not allow any gathering be held for Imam Hussein's mourning. As I had grown up with the mourning ceremony of Imam Hussein since my childhood, I said loudly, damn him. As I told this, Bahram was pale and said out of horror, do you want to be detained? 2 years later, Qasem Soleimani started going to a mosque to learn the exegesis of the Quran. This shaped up his religious character little by little. The Shah's regime had set up bars and discos in provincial centers to corrupt youth, but it was not successful in Kerman. In the summer of 1976, there was held a feast by singers and dancers in the city. Young Qasem and two of his friends showed their opposition and anger through puncturing the tires of their cars. Martyr Qasem Soleimani continues in his autobiography, As a teenager, I would fight immorality with honor, and I feared no one. However, I had no clear information on SAVAK, the Shah's intelligence and security apparatus. I had just heard its name several times, but I was not afraid of anything. Elsewhere, Martyr Soleimani writes, It was the Muharram month of 1976. I was looking out of the hotel window. Opposite the hotel was the municipality and police office of Kerman. A young girl was walking on the pavement. A police officer disturbed her. The act was very upsetting for me on the day of Ashura, so I decided to confront him regardless of the consequences. Young Qasem rushed to the street and knocked down the cop with karate moves. The cop hooted his whistle and two other cops ran toward him. Qasem ran to the hotel and hid under a bed. A number of cops looked for him but couldn't find him. On his trip to the holy city of Mashhad, Qasem Soleimani heard the name of Imam Khomeini from two young boys for the first time. As the anti-regime demonstrations escalated in the city of Qom, and also in the city of Tabriz in 1978, the city of Kerman changed totally as well. The chants of death to the Shah could be heard here and there. As a brave youth, Qasem Soleimani would write death to the Shah and greetings to Khomeini on the walls of city. He writes in his autobiography, I would look at Imam Khomeini's picture several times every day, as if he was by me and I was reading the Quran beside him. He was a part of me. That was the first episode of the 5-part special series on Martyr Soleimani. Tomorrow, we will continue with the second part. The second part will be on his role in the 8-year imposed war.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.